This is WBAA. I'm Betty Carson. Nick Schinkel, the director of the West Lafayette Public Library, reviews Betsy Woodman's debut novel, Jana Beebe's Excellent Fortunes. Schinkel begins his review by reading from the book.
Dear Mrs. Laird, Jana read, it has come to our attention that you are the sole living heir of the late Ramsey Grant, whose will we probated in 1930. At that time, there was one piece of property that could not be distributed because of the terms of the lease, which only expired in 1955. Further complications regarding succession have only recently been resolved. We are now happy to inform you that you are the owner of the Jolly Grant House, number 108 Central Bazaar, adjacent to Ramachandran's Treasure Emporium and across from Royal Tailors, Hamaranagra, Uttar Pradesh. We assume that you are aware of the building's historic importance. All matters related to the execution of your grandfather's will are now resolved and all property distributed. There should be no impediment to your taking possession of the building. Enclosed herewith, you will find the key. The Jolly Grant House, thought Jana. Extraordinary that it was still standing, let alone that none of her grandfather Grant's Anglo-Indian descendants had lived to take possession. A shred of memory came back to her of a visit to the town in 1912 when she was 10. The family had put up at the Victoria Hotel, even though Grandfather Grant had plenty of room in the guest house of his compound, 3 or 4 miles away, then on the outskirts of town. "You're not actually going to visit him," Jana's father had said, "and take the children?" And left unsaid, expose them to that woman, Grandfather Grant's Indian wife. "James, you're being so stuffy. He's almost 90," Jana's mother had answered. The little exchange summed up the two sides of Jana's family. How many generations of them, soldiers, civil servants, engineers, architects, had worked and lived in India? 5? 6? From the beginning, some, like her father, considered India a place to earn their living while keeping away from Indians as much as possible. Stuffy folks who insisted on boundaries, categories, and boxes. But others, like her mother, adored India and were never completely happy anywhere else. Grandfather Grant, who looked like a proper Victorian gentleman, was actually of the second sort. A throwback to the 18th century when it was commonplace for a British man to have an Indian wife. He got away with his eccentricity, Jana's father always maintained, only because of his wealth. So opens Jana Beebe's Excellent Fortunes, a novel by Betsy Woodman. And as our novel opened there, we find ourselves in 1960 in India. The Indian people have taken back their country, but British colonial tradition lives on, as we heard, having left officially only 13 years before our novel opens. Enter Scottish expatriate Jana Beebe. Born and raised, at least to age 8, in British Raj, India, Jana had returned to the land of her youth as the newlywed to a Christian missionary. Left alone with only her longtime ayah, Mary, after the death of her 3 children and then her husband, because of smallpox, Jana has made her way in life by offering violin lessons to Indians and Brits alike, gaining a position as a live-in music teacher to the children of a local Indian prince. But Jana's luxury-fringed life as a music teacher to princely offspring slowly erodes her inborn sense of adventure and excitement. And so, as a 50-something widower, she jumps at the chance to inherit a rundown British castle, or certainly large Victorian home, nestled in the hilly center of the small town of Hamaranagra, set high in the mountain country of Himalayan area India. Well, Jana finds she has a choice at this point in her life, remain in the beloved yet chaotic India of her youth and now her later age, or return to the warm and cozy security of Scotland to live as a pensioner with her son. Indeed, her son encourages her to come back to Scotland and live with him in the hills of northern Britain, writing to her in a short letter, "Mother, you're too old to live alone. Come live in Glasgow. Isn't that where you belong? I grant you that it was noble to live as a missionary and take care of father all those years. And I suppose that the world does need musicians. But do you need to be one of them? And aren't you tired of living from hand to mouth? What if you get sick? Remember that you'll always be an outsider there." Jana had to smile. Jack, her son, had always been a little old lady. As a boy, he'd preferred reading to exploring the mission compound or climbing trees. She'd never found a lizard in his pocket. Safety first had been his motto as a 6-year-old, and apparently it still was. "Now I ask you," Jana said, Almost aloud. Too old? 58? And alone? Who was alone in India, apart from a few prayer-mumbling sadhus? The only time in her life she'd felt alone was during the 6 lonely years in Scotland as a child. In contrast, going to a Himalayan hill station with Mary and Mr. Ganguly did not strike her as a lonely proposition, and she liked the idea of living in Grandfather Grant's house anyway. She'd felt for some time that her usefulness at the Nawab's palace was at an end. "Mary," said Jana, "we may have a new home." She sketched the details, knowing that Mary would like the number 108. The Ganges had 108 names. The god Krishna had played the flute for 108 milkmaids. Sure enough, Mary's eyes lit up. "Very auspicious, Jana Mem." She took the tea tray and headed back into the palace. Well, despite the disrepair, the far-off-the-beaten-path location of the jolly Grant House, to our delight, Jana chooses joyful chaos over droll security. The jolly Grant House had worked its magic. And so off she goes, with her longtime Aya, or housekeeper and nanny, Mary, and her longtime companion and ring-necked parrot, Mr. Ganguly, off on yet another adventure in her already not-so-quiet life. From the moment Jana decides on taking on this tremendous fixer-upper project to be paid from what shrinks to become only a modest inheritance from her grandfather, she discovers and takes into her life an exotic and a humorous cast of somewhat misfit characters who both help support her industrious efforts and also suck Jana's already small inheritance to an even smaller monthly stipend as she works to keep them fed and clothed and the house in new repair. This welcoming and deftly drawn cast of characters are folks that Jana comes to see as her new family. Be they British or Indian, petty aristocrat or street urchin, these are characters that explore the idiosyncrasies of mid-20th century India, a land with ancient and proud roots and quite a few colonial trappings. Through the usually gentle flow of this novel, we learn bits and pieces of Jana's backstory as well of the supporting characters, who are all fleshed out with sympathy for their strong points as well as their foibles. Indeed, Jana Beebe herself is, as another reviewer has noted, quote, so wise, generous, and comfortable with who she is that it's a pleasure to go with her, end quote. There is, of course, a looming catastrophe once we get well into our novel that our intrepid Jana must head off with the help of her new friends. The threatened destruction of the town by a dam that the well-meaning central government of India means to build to provide electricity for this province and more. Not a small obstacle to be overcome. But in the best tradition of Alexander McCall Smith's number one lady detective series, or Jan Karen's gentle tales set in rural North Carolina, or for those who remember and still revel in her exploits, the doughty, gray-haired Dorothy Polifax, in this rousing can-do senior spirit of the best Marigold Hotel, Jana and her merry band of misfits come up with a unique but story-friendly solution to scotching the threatened dam, and triumph and good sense wins out over bureaucratic wisdom. This is the first of a proposed series for The Amazing Fortunes of Jana Beebe, and it's quiet fiction that sings. The language is lyrical and smooth, and the storyline, along with its tributaries, are gilded with just enough small joys and surprises, while also fraught with just enough gentle troubles to keep us engaged from page one. I will be glad to meet up again with Jana Beebe and her friends in a sequel to this novel, or just enjoy the tantalizing joys to be found curled up with this good book on another lazy afternoon's day. As the exploits of Jana Beebe end with this novel, we read, that evening Jana sat in the tower thinking how wonderful and peaceful it is to be home. She watched the sun going down, dipping into the orange of the first stripe on the horizon, and then falling deeper and disappearing into the browny mauve of the next layer. The trees and buildings she could see from her new home were black cutouts, shadow puppets against the evening display of dark and light. Mr. Ganguly flapped his wings. She played him a few jigs on the violin, and he danced on his perch. But then her own music was drowned out by the strains of Lal Bahadur Pun practicing with his bagpipes. He was sounding a retreat march, a march traditional for when the day's work was done and the troops returned to the barracks. Jana put down her fiddle and scratched Mr. Gangley on the head. "We're home, aren't we?" she asked. "Good bird," he said. "It's a delightful read. It's a quiet read. And it's also a read that gives us something to think about and takes us just a bit into mid-last century India. Jana Beebe's Excellent Fortunes, a novel by Betsy Woodman. It's available at any fine local library, as well as, of course, the West Lafayette Public Library.
That was Nick Schinkel, the director of the West Lafayette Public Library. He's reviewed Jana Beebe's Excellent Fortunes by Betsy Woodman. You can find more on this book and other book reviews by Nick Schinkel on our website at wbaa.org.